Brigadier Vickers, Reel 2.
I would like to... There was another variation, but a very important one in Korea, and I was briefed personally by the CIGS about this, in a short moment I had with him, and this was the question of the divisional commander, who was in fact appointed by the governments of the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and approved by India, and so was the G1, and so was the AQ, and so was the CRA. And I think the CRE, we were Commonwealth appointments. The rest of the staff then, Canada supplied the DAQMG, UK the DAAG. There was an agreement between the Commonwealth nations, but the five principal people were Commonwealth appointments, and there was a good deal of importance to that. But every contingent in the Commonwealth Division had the right of referring back to its own government. For instance, if my divisional commander, General Castles, was given an order which he thought was impossible, he could, of course, say, he could object and say to the American Corps commander, I can't do that, or it's impossible, or I think it's unnecessary. And if he felt very strongly about it, he could then say to the American commander, look, I feel so strongly about this that I must refer it back to my government. And until I get my government's agreement, I am unable to comply with that order. Well, of course, this same power of referring back to the government existed for the Canadian and the Australian and the New Zealand and the Indian forces. So that if divisional headquarters, the divisional commander, issued an order which the Canadians didn't like, they could refer it back to Canada. And of course the result was that we had breathing down our necks all the time the CGS Canada, the CGS Australia, and the CGS New Zealand, and we didn't have the CNC Indian Army, but they were always coming and looking after their national interests there. And I think as they got more confident and the division welded into what eventually became a magnificent team, I think that was less important. But in the early days when we were gathering the robber barons in, I can remember one or two extremely difficult moments when the Canadians were told to do something and they just refused, for not very good reasons, I think. And we had put a lot of pressure on them. And in fact, to their eternal credit, they sent out, I think, the vice chief or something like that to examine the problem and tell the Canadians to get on with it and get on with the battle. But it was always there. The other thing was that as we were an independent division sitting with a rather ad hoc LOC behind us, British Commonwealth Forces Korea, and our theatre headquarters was, what, several thousand miles away, we did get a lot of direct signals and correspondence from the very highest level in London. And as an AQ, I received three personal signals of great length in 1 week from the Quartermaster General. The AQ looks forward, he doesn't look back. But this was, and I did from the AG, or the, about VD. And then the CIGS on another matter came out to the divisional commander, and I remember my impression was that they were very badly informed in London as to the truth on the ground, particularly the Quartermaster General in cold, wet warfare clothing. I was amazed at the ignorance that was displayed in his signals, and one had to be rather tactful going back. You can't say to the Quartermaster General, don't be stupid, 2 and 2 makes 4, not 7. But this question, in the early days, it was always there, and I think an enormous success of the divisional commander was that he, by his sheer personality and success of command, and the fact that the division functioned efficiently and fought extremely well, that almost disappeared. But initially, by gum, it was difficult, and you had to We had a little motto on the AQ staff. It was known as avoid the avoidables. When you issued an order, you thought about it, and it was a routine. And it took a little longer, but you would consult, and then you'd issue it and make sure that you enforced it. But it doesn't happen to British Division, and that meant that the AQ and the G1 were not only looking over their shoulders back to the LSC, but were looking right back to their national capitals, which was a complication.
Did you feel that this remote control from London was oppressive?
The operational control of the division was vested in the Joint Chiefs in Australia. But then, of course, each national chiefs of staff had responsibilities direct. Ours was mostly domestic. Casualty rates and DD and reinforcement rates from the AG. Equipment. I don't think that the Q staff and the War Office have anything to be very proud of for the first 12 months in Korea. I think after that they really pulled their finger out and were very good indeed. The first 12 months they were caught short. They hadn't got the depots stocked for the right stuff, nor was it being made. But it put an enormous additional responsibility on the Q staff, and some of the adjutant generals' questions about leave and BD and rotation. The other sad thing, of course, is that they shipped battalions out there who were simply not fit to go to Korea. I can remember one county regiment arriving, and not one of its four rifle company commanders were members of that regiment. And they'd been filled up with bits and pieces from half a dozen other regiments. The CO had been changed a month before they came out. They hadn't done any proper training, and they were no damn good at all for the first time. We only had a fortnight to sort of train them. And the first time they went and confronted the Chinese, they were a rebel. Eventually they became a jolly good sound battalion, but you had the divisional commander, and he's an excellent brigadier in that case, had to nurse that battalion 4 to 6 months before you could trust them. I mean that. I mean, I can remember Jim saying, we can't do that because X battalion. No, that won't do. And the brigadier, it was a restriction because our reinforcement policy was, there were various other pressures on it, of course. The Lao was going on still. I think the Mau Mau was still. There was certainly something in the Near East going on, and problems of Germany. Very complicated.
Did the training of incoming battalions fall within your sphere of responsibility?
The training fell. We had an extremely good Canadian training, G2 training, on a thing we set up, who ran the exercises, familiarisation exercises, and we used to get the unit that get off the trooper in the base. We'd keep them 4 days in the base, and we'd check their equipment complete because we had stores there, and then they'd be railed up or sent up by sea to Incheon, and then we'd put them into a camp which we set up called Britannia Camp, which was about 10 miles behind main divisional headquarters. It's a very good training area where you could do field firing, and there they were taken over by this training team, and they had, I think, 21 days after they arrived, they had to relieve a battalion in the line, or go up and relieve the outgoing battalion. And in that time, all the soldiers fired all their weapons and spent nights out and days out and were taught. Teams came back from the battalions and so on and so forth. And then we fed up company commanders and fed up platoon commanders. And they did 72 hours with a battalion in contact and so on and so forth. It was very well arranged, and General Jim Castles was insistent that a battalion be given a good sniff at the dog before they were put off. And it was not much administrative thing. You wanted a few extra transports, and once you got the camp set up, and we had a Korean team running it with a rather badly wounded infantry captain who wanted a job who ran it, it was a continual sausage thing. very easy, but you had to keep an eye on the battalion and go down as an AQ and visit them quite frequently and see what their problems were and help them in, and then you fed them in. It was a good system, but we had an excellent training officer. He really was very good, full of imagination, and a nice chap, and everybody accepted him, so that was a great success, which he got a well-deserved decoration.
What sort of skills did they need to acquire for the specifically Korean conditions?
Well, you wanted to know something about what sort of enemy you were up against. That was the first thing, and you could teach them that a little bit. You could buy experience from other people. They wanted to know that they were going into a very heavily fortified position with enormous bands of wire and things around them, at the type of combat conditions they'd find, which was sitting in static defence, but with a very active patrolling policy and big fighting patrols, two platoons and things like that. Weapon handling under conditions of extreme dust and heat, and weapon handling under conditions of extreme cold, when you had to strip the weapons and have them dry, and that sort of thing. We had a good Australian hygiene team who went round every company and taught them about the perils of career. I mean, you never thought of bathing in the rivers unless you had shoes on, because they're little things called, I think they're called spine fish, and they can paralyse you. You never, in fact, stopped in an evacuated Korean village. You just went right through it because there was terrible danger of getting Songo hemorrhagic fever, which came from the mites of dead rats and things like that. How to look after yourself for frostbite, how to keep yourself clean and stop having lice and ticks and scabies and all that sort of thing. This was all part of the drill. It was a complete program. You had to start to get them used to operating by night, and this was continuous.
What about specific tactics for the sort of terrain over which they were operating?
Well,
could you rely upon standard minor infantry tactics for patrolling and that sort of operation, or did you have to adapt the field manual solutions to Korean conditions?
No, I mean, the first 4 months, 5 months when I was there, we were south of the Imjin, and we closed up the Imjin. That was fairly mobile warfare, and advanced from about, I'm guessing, 25 miles. We closed up the Imjin, and the Chinese did not hold it very strongly at the far side. We probed it, and then eventually we did a two-brigade attack over the Imjin, which met with very little resistance. And it got forward a certain, not far enough forward over the Imjin to give us room. And so we then came up against what they call the main Chinese winter line. And the corps commander, I think quite rightly, in September, the division had been formed in June, by which time it had moved 20, 30 miles north and across the Imjin. The corps commander decided that the one US corps would take out the Chinese winter line. This was a major thing. It was a one US Marine, 3 Cav, 45th Arkansas National Guard, Republic of Korea, Capital Division, and the Commonwealth. It was a 5-division attack. Lots of aeroplanes, lots of artillery, and we had a proper set too for 4 days. Tremendous success. And ourselves and the Marines got through and took all our objectives to time. The rest of the Americans had a slight problem. So, once we got there, we occupied a defensive line, which we had largely pre-selected from our photographs and reconnaissance. And the boys dug like hell and wire. And from then on, it was almost a Maginot line. I mean, the wire in some cases down the gullies was 200 yards thick. And it was 10, 12, 15 feet high. And of course, our artillery defensive tasks were honed to an absolute razor sharpness and were extremely quick and efficient. And there were certain places where not even a Chinaman could get through the wire, so you could almost ignore that. You just covered it, but there was the danger there. So really the job was sitting in defence. But he had to be prepared to go out on a fighting or reconnaissance patrol. And we did keep up a very high level of patrol. It was good for morale, and it certainly prevented the Chinese, who were good at night, in worrying us. But there was a very intense patrol battle in that cold, wet warfare, where what won it for us was the infrared night sight, of which the Australians were absolute past masters. And eventually we had a team of Australians, I don't know the details of it, but I think we had 16 of these equipments, of which 10 were used by Australians. And they used to go out with the patrols. And they used to come back having shot 5 Chinamen stone dead during the night, who simply didn't know what was happening. And we dominated no man's land because of that. So the Australians, and that little, what they call look-sees, were absolutely superb. And they were very good, very experienced, and they would go to the town and live with the patrol for 2 or 3 days to get to know the blokes and then go out with them. We had no problem, very successful. But there was something in their makeup that made them very good with those weapons.
You mentioned in clothing earlier on. Was there any way you could supplement clothing by local purchase in Japan or in Korea itself to provide warm and waterproof clothing for the troops before it came out from England?
I don't. Local purchase, perhaps a little bit. Gloves, I think. The problem in Korea is the extremes of climate. And for instance, your soldiers on the 1st of August were in KD or tropical clothing, and the midday temperature in the Indian Valley would go up to 100 plus in the shade. 90 days later, is it right? August, September, October. Yeah. 90 days later, on the 1st of November, you'd get 25 degrees of frost at night. So in 90 days, as an AQ, you had to change the division from tropical into battle dress and then into cold wet warfare. That was quite a thing. Took a lot of transport and a lot of detailed planning to do it properly with the quartermasters and to prevent wastage. The first year before I got out there, the soldiers were simply not equipped at all, and they had greatcoats, they had leather jerkins, they had they had a camouflage smock, but they had no proper boots, they had no proper gloves. There was no provision for additional socks, there was no proper thermal underwear, and so on and so forth. But the first winter I was there, we got our new combat equipment, some of it experimental, which had been made at very high speed in the UK. Marvellous performance. And by and large, it was pretty good. It was considerably better than the Americans. Our boots were better than the Americans. But our gloves were useless. And you've got to have gloves in cold, wet warfare. Otherwise, you touch a weapon with your bare hands, you lose the skin of it. It was a major problem, clothing. For instance, it was a standing order that a man always had with him 3 pairs of socks, one on, and one pair over each shoulder, underneath his shirt, so that they were warm and dry. And he changed his socks every 4 hours. And if he didn't, you could put him on a charge. And really, the blokes realised this because they saw the result of frostbite and so on and so forth, and they realised that if they looked after their feet, they wouldn't be in agony and so on and so forth. And I think, by and large, it was a difficult order to implement, but they did it marvellous. And our degree of frostbite in the division was minuscule. Americans was 7 or 8%. But clothing was a problem. But at the end of my first winter there, we had got the clothing for the next winter in. So So there was good planning forward after a frightful start before I got there. And the equipment we had was super. I've got my combat jacket to this day, and it is absolutely waterproof. It was made for me because I was so big. It's showerproof, or a little better, and you could breathe through it, and it was marvellous equipment. I think it's even better now. But the bulk of clothing, moving them up, was very difficult, and doing the distribution was... Your ordinary Ordnance Field Park couldn't handle it, and you had to set up a special organisation with the ISC companies doing this. And you'd really almost have to bring a battalion out into a reserve position to let the quartermaster spend at least 2 days. It was no good lobbing it out. The chap had to be fitted properly, then he could survive the winter. But it took a long time. And you only had really a fortnight to re-equip them. You had to get the division changed in a fortnight. Quite a big thing.
Presumably, this policy of making them change clothing frequently put a strain on the field laundry.
Yes. We had two. We had a Canadian one, a very bellicose Canadian one. It was always right up in the leading. But they had a marvellous and very good laundry system and marvellous hot showers, very important. And we had an ordinary RASC bath, laundry and bath unit. We eventually took the laundry back to Seoul and employed something like 300 Koreans in it and had a sergeant RASC running it. And my memory is it was extremely good. I used to get clothing washed and back in 48 hours, 3 times a week, and the soldiers were allowed 2 bundles a week, I think. It was very important. And all the problem of getting Private Bifkin's own shirt and things back seemed to work very well. I used to go down and look at the laundry. It's always a mass of dead silent Korean women, great steam and a lot of soap, but it seemed to work. The input was enormous. The filthy clothes that came back. And as a result, I think the division was pretty healthy and didn't suffer from appalling diseases.
It's also said to be very, very good for morale if clean clothes are regularly available.
Mail and clean clothes. I think morale in the Commonwealth Division was tremendous. There's nothing like, if you want a British battalion to perform really well, put them next door to a French-Canadian battalion who can watch them, and that sort of thing. Or put the Australians where they're watched by the KOSB, or something like that. Competition is very good. But there was tremendous feeling of unity in the Commonwealth Division because we were in an American theatre, and we had 1 US Marines on our left and 1 US Cavalry on our right, 2 of the best formations in the American Armed Forces. We had a very high respect for us, and we knew we were good, and we knew we were better. Our defensive artillery fire was the wonder of Korea, and the steadfastness of the soldiers. We never lost, seriously lost, any bit of real estate of any importance when I was there. When Speakman got his VC, the KOSB were knocked off quite a large lump of important real estate, but we had it back in 48 hours, but we didn't lose any real estate, and we were never penetrated. And we know, I mean, I've learned since the war, that the Chinese had a very healthy respect for us, and if you could have gone to their core headquarters, I'm told they had a China graph line either side, said, leave that alone. Because if you poked a stick in the Commonwealth Division, it reacted very violently. But I'm biased. I thought it was a magnificent fighting formation, and marvellously commanded by Jim Castle.
Presumably the speed of the artillery reaction was due to very good radio comms.
Yes, and line. Signals was a great problem to begin with. Oh, poor Arthur Atkinson, the CR6. He visibly aged, rather like the man coming out of Shangri-La. He had a terrible problem. I think radio is a bit difficult in Korea. Landline is very difficult. But when you got into a static position, we had the 3 field regiments. We had a 4.2 mortar regiment, which was a hell of a punch. And speed of reaction and their accuracy was simply superb. From anywhere, one FOO with a Duke of Wellington, as I can remember, got slightly windy, and I think within, I think the reaction for a Victor target, the whole of the bloody lot, plus an American regiment, was 3 minutes to shells on ground in a very close in. Oh, it was super. Americans used to come and watch us, and they wouldn't believe it. Of course, the Americans all go back to a fire direction centre where the decisions are made. Our decisions are made by the lieutenant right up in the front leading company, and they're monitored by somebody who knows. And I must say, the artillery was super. But by God, it did not use a lot of ammunition. They were very good indeed.
That comparison of systems of controlling artillery fire makes it appear to me that the American way of doing it had more in common with an industrial corporation.
They didn't appear, and I heard the CRA saying this, they would never delegate and trust their FOOs. I think even if the FOO was firing his own field artillery battalion, he had a monitor on it. I mean, there was a chap at the fire direction centre who would release the targets. He would say to the chaps, fire, not the FOO, the British FOO out there would say, you know, do the bang, fire for effect, off they'd go. Complete trust, experience. We had an American 8-inch regiment which was supported ourselves in the one cab, and we had our own communications to them, and they allowed us to do the OPs for them. So we did it, and when they fired for the cavalry, they went through the fire direction centre. When they fired for us, they went onto the British system, and they were tickled pink. They had a lovely code name. They were called the Persuaders. 8-inch. They were they were a rightfully good lot of chaps, and very accurate. And
were they used for the traditional role for counter battery, or were they used to generally thicken up the?
No, they were normally. We had such good air cover that you could have very up to date photographs. They were normally used on taking on sort of Chinese division and corps headquarters. So if the Chinese 33rd Corps got stroppy, it got 18 rounds of 8-inch, very accurately in and around its village.